here goes. Okay, so what if I told you that right now, somewhere in a very remote corner of existence, a group of immortals are having a conversation? Let's say the conversation is boisterous, fast, snaking among subjects and the implications of subjects and quick sketches of the hulking psychic remnants of subjects long dismantled. The immortals having these conversations lend no credence to the bundle of charismatic myths we might call conventional wisdom. They are constantly discovering their world and themselves in a mood of luminous novelty. And let's say, too, that they are the kind of immortals who die invariably, their experience a procession of infinite consciousnesses emerging from the undifferentiated soup of the inconceivable past, eventually resolving into the benign, ubiquitous unself that has always been their home. That, comrades, sounds to me like some party. I'm trying to be cute here, but of course, you know I'm really talking about Jeremy Huvenar because this is an introduction for Jeremy Huvenar. And what I mean to say is that if, as Nathaniel Mackey has written, quoting Lewis Brenner, quoting Cyrano Bokhar Salif Tal, language is a fruit of which the skin is called chatter, the flesh eloquence, and the seed good sense. Jeremy Huvenar may well be poetry's premier smoothie maker, delivering a full complement of language's robust, weird nourishment and flavor, all its feints and advances in every sip. Jeremy's is a poetry with the good sense of true contradiction. In plenipotentiary humility, with lingering velocity, it is a laser-focused meander through fast-dispersing agglomerations of language and thought. In his 2012 collection, Cold Mountain Mirror Displacement, Jeremy writes, "This typing is a mountaintop from which I withhold my pronouncements while the next nuance of selfhood finishes downloading, which means I believe in completion as an inherent quality of being. If I'm not a student anymore, I must be a thief." A crucial word in some of Jeremy's more recent work is insolvency. It comes up in the poems from his 2016 Resolving Host chapbook, Our Insolvency, his 2017 Ugly Duckling chapbook, Insolvency, Insolvency, and elsewhere. It's the perfect keyword for so much of Jeremy's writing, with its insistence on pooling the negative, its eager embrace of shortfall and faltering. Emerging from a precariat that's been forced to join a game of political economy already in overtime, the voice in Jeremy's poems uses insolvency as a kind of timestamp, situating us among those who would rather stay where we are than try to keep up with a global order whose rot outpaces our canniest sense of utility. Jeremy writes, "O devotional subcontracts, in the vertical halls citing a new thoroughbred framework, I hear the causeways by which these marvelous apparitions of corn syrup plus benefits renege on their archaic torsos, reclining in donations of echo that light ivory and afar functionally, if not tonally, war." Yes. Poetry is an art where a man was named Bjorn, and since Bjorn means bear, and a bear is kind of like a cross between a bee and a wolf, his name became Beowulf, and we all pretended for a long, long time that that was reasonable. How much can any of us pretend is reasonable, Jeremy's poems implicitly ask, as they careen between beakers of language distilled to its active and incomplete substrates. Heroically refusing the cuckoo implication that anything anyone says is about its referent rather than something else, the speaker of Jeremy's poems can be found embedded in a history of compromise and simultaneously walking down the street, developing symptoms at a leisurely pace, pace all the soloing and dissimulations underheard as post-ambivalent manufacts, all-inclusive shrugs enmeshed in baudlerized vicissitude. Oh, I'm muting you. In his prose, Jeremy enlarges the frame, filters at coarser resolution, but with an equal sense of apt emergence. There is no detritus in Jeremy's world, only orphaned signification. Under a regime of sanctified consumer choice, we encounter the digital shopping cart as a node of latent subjectivity, ambiguously tensed between inactivity and overstimulation. In his attention to the work of artists like John Carpenter and Peter Straub, Jeremy gives us back some of what distraction has stolen, both the affects of horror and the defects of commodified form. In fact, if I had to come up with a name for Jeremy's overall aesthetic, I think I would call it anti-distractionism, a mode in which all ground becomes object and every object is, of course, a subject, speaking through the brittleness of its situation, calling out its lonesome connection to absolutely everything. Today, as we wake each morning to proclaim the kingdom of object ground confusion, I think we need his tragic reformations, his leaked small talk from the party primeval, his good sense of calling a man named Bjorn Beowulf and calling purposefulness the warm money of near spothood more urgently than ever. Live from the island of Manhattan, please lose your fucking minds for the one and only wonderful Jeremy Huvenar.
Oh, wait. Now I'm unmuted. Thank you, Ian, so much. That was incredible. I'm flabbergasted. It made me think, one of the things it made me think was, if there are smoothies, is there such a thing as roughies? And I wanted to introduce you all to my son. There you go. Okay. Okay, thank you so much, everybody, and to Artist Space and Segue for having me. Thank you, Dia. I look forward to your reading. Ian, that made me very emotional, sorry. I am indeed going to read about, among other things, John Carpenter and Peter Straub, and probably there's something about insolvency in there, at least because most of what's good in anything I do is stolen and not paid back. Okay. So this is a work in progress. It's kind of situated between a poem and an essay. It's a little restless that way. And I'll just get started. It's called Wound First Into the Future. That comes from a David Levi Strauss essay, who he is one of my favorite writers, and I highly recommend you check out David Levi Strauss. Wound First Into the Future, Part One. Notes on Corners, Thresholds, and John Carpenter's The Thing. The meaning of writing is always the next text, Alan Davies. About 15 years ago, I read a book called The Way of the Pilgrim. The impetus for this was in rereading Salinger's Franny and Zoe, a favorite book of mine in my late teens. In Franny and Zoe, Zoe, older brother to Franny, they of the Glass family, attempts to console Franny, home from college and disillusioned. My memory of this book is hazy. I mostly recall a feeling. There are a few images like a bathtub, a bathrobe with big pockets full of weird things, a lot of smoking, a significant telephone call. Or maybe console isn't the right word. It starts with that, but it ends somewhere else, in a feeling place that to me is always around corners. There's a kind of laughing sky that exists only around corners. My memory of The Way of a Pilgrim is also hazy now. It's a journey, a hero's journey of sorts, full of meaningful encounters. This is the book that Franny is reading in Franny and Zoe. It has something to do with her inconsolability, or the state that she's in that's bigger than inconsolable, the state of unresolvability. I think that if I went back and reread Salinger's book now, I might not have the same reaction I had at first and second readings. I think I might feel a little disgusted, if disgusted can be a matter of degrees. I think I might find its presumptions of wisdom facile, so much charm and privilege. In my late teens, though, I really bought into this stew of precociousness, genius, quirk, charm, wisdom, and spirituality. The big thing in The Way of a Pilgrim is that the protagonist, the pilgrim, who could be you, goes about the world while trying to live according to St. Paul's dictum that one should pray without ceasing. I mean, I would also feel the laughing sky in the corners if I reread Franny and Zoe. It would fill me with something, but it's something I'm no longer sure I can trust. Reading this at first at about 17 or 18, along with some other things, got me feeling religious. This religious feeling lasted until around my mid-20s. Why is Franny in a state of unresolvability? Why can't she stop crying? I remember saying in my mid-20s to a coworker something like, "It is perhaps my greatest fault that I'm forever looking for God in a book." Yikes, what was I trying to advertise there? Also, God is all about books, right? All kinds of gods have a lot to do with books. It's words, logos, creation is a text. I wanted to be the pilgrim, and Zoe, and Franny. I wanted to be the whole glass family, probably. I wanted to be in on the secret of the laughing sky. I think that what this means is that I wanted a family, and at the same time, I wanted to be a lone traveler, wandering under that sky, a little crazy, Shuka, out of the house. Like Han Shan, Cold Mountain, whose poems appealed to me and later in life, crazy, wild, bewildered, writing poems on rocks and trees. My friend Tom says he's afraid that if he started crying, he might not ever be able to stop. For Nietzsche, Tom says, it was the same thing, but with laughing. What if I started praying and found that I couldn't stop? I recommended a book to Tom, Coco by Peter Straub. This book got under my skin in a certain way. What did it was the visionary psychosis-like state one of the characters, M.O. Dengler, enters while enduring horrific fighting in the Vietnam War. He becomes childlike in a way, full of wonder, while all of this horror is happening around him, all this murder, all this ruination of human bodies. After this, Dengler never stops becoming a child for the rest of his life. At one point, while taking shelter from a hail of gunfire, bodies exploding all around, bodies jumping suddenly into shimmering red clouds and disappearing, death, 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 he turns to another character and says kind of idly, "Don't you think God does everything simultaneously?" There's a thing that I love, this drawing by Baltimore artist and poet Lesser Gonzalez Alvarez. It's a Venn diagram where the left circle says laughing and the right circle says crying and the overlapping section says soaring. A few times this thing has happened to my partner Dee Dee, where she enters a state of laughing and crying simultaneously. I have never entered this exact state of experiencing contradictory emotions and affects at the same time, but yes, I think it seems right to refer to the soaring. What would it be like to exist in that all the time? I think that this is what praying without ceasing would be, perhaps the only sane response to the world we now live in. Then, all this bleeding and hellishness happening around him, Dengler continues, "What I like about that idea is that in a funny way it means that the universe actually created itself, which means that it goes on creating itself, get me? So the destruction is part of this creation that goes on all the time, and on top of it is the real kicker. Destruction is the part of creation that we think is beautiful. Another thing I love that I think is beautiful, a drawing by David Shrigley called Him. On a sheet of staff paper, a single note repeats over and over beneath each note, just God, 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 until the end of the page. Mark E. Smith said, the three R's are repetition, repetition, repetition. Many things I love, I learned about from other people. I love the fall because my wife loves the fall. I love Peter Straub because my dad loves Peter Straub. The pilgrim learns prayer, learns to love prayer and access love through prayer from a stranger he encounters on his journey. I can't deny that there's a powerful sense of love in Franny and Zoe. That space in Lesser's drawing, soaring, that's like love, a perfect love. A perfect love is a palimpsest, a simultaneity. My friend Anna has a small book about listening to Joy Division put out by Perfect Lovers Press, a press started by Dana Ward and Paul Kors that took its name from the artwork entitled Perfect Lovers by Felix Gonzalez Torres. Two battery-powered clocks placed next to each other and set to the same time. Simultaneously the same time in two different same times, the clocks eventually go out of sync as their batteries die at different speeds. All our lives, we die at different speeds. Felix Gonzalez Torres says, time is something that scares me or used to. This piece I made with the two clocks is the scariest thing I've ever done. I wanted to face it. I wanted those two clocks right in front of me ticking. If you were to stare at those two clocks and let your eyes relax, they would start to overlap. This is the space, is this the space where one can come overcome one sphere of time? The first piece by Felix Gonzalez Torres I experienced in person was at the Baltimore Museum of Art, an enormous blue beaded curtain. I loved it. Sort of everything at once, a painting, a drawing, a sculpture. It's musical, it's textual, tactile, a threshold. Simultaneity is a state always on the threshold of itself. This is what people are like. Where those two clocks overlap, soaring, the laughing sky around corners, prayer without ceasing, everything simultaneously. While passing through the beaded curtain, slowing to experience it, that narrow threshold space opens up. It makes a new spatial dimension and it creates a new emotion. People are thresholds and on the thresholds of themselves, ourselves. The first horror novel I read was Shadowland by Peter Straub. I snuck it off of my dad's bookshelf, a place that fascinated me, held me enthralled, a vast place. I try and remember when life felt enormous in front of that bookshelf. In front of two overlapping clocks, passing through the beaded curtain, inside of us is an enormous threshold. Shadowland is about magic, children and magic, and it is wondrous and terrifying. It takes place in a seemingly endless house, in a seemingly endless woods, in a seemingly endless night, and there are terrifying things around every corner. Near the end, the protagonist, Tom Flanagan, is crucified. It takes some guts for a writer to crucify a child, but in many ways, Tom is more adult than any adult. Because of his initiation into an aptitude for magic, he becomes an old being. Another thing I love is a small book that records a conversation between artists Amy Silman and Greg Bordowitz. There's a moment when they speak about new emotions. Greg Bordowitz says, "I believe that we produce new emotions. Emotions are collectively produced. They're not produced by ourselves alone." Amy Silman says about her paintings that they are versions of things at the same time that they are those things. She continues, "So maybe new emotions are about dealing with time differently. Maybe before the 20th century, there was more linearity in time, in the appearance of time, and now we've entered into this weird sci-fi time where time moves forwards and backwards at the same time." I have always felt when writing poetry that the poetry is a version of poetry at the same time that it is poetry, and that it moves with and against the time of itself. This is kind of how I conceive of prosody, that overlapping threshold space where a thing is what it is and also a version of itself. On its own threshold, two clocks looked at with relaxed eyes. Amy Silman also once said in an email that she thought of prosody and writing like space and painting. This seems right, painterly space being both there and not there at the same time. My friend Ryan wants to find ghosts in this way, not present, not absent, not present. Another thing I love is contrastive reduplication, where you say a thing twice to indicate a new meaning, like when we were kids. Do you like them or do you like them? The word doubled, overlapped, makes a new meaning. I also love in Franny and Zoe when Franny is disparaging one of her college professors because she knows that he musses up his hair before he comes out to give a lecture. It's not genuine, and she's obsessed with the problem of being genuine. She hates it in the professor because she sees it in herself. Zoe sees the professor in another way with a kind of charitable attitude. I have for a long time now always tried to make sure my hair is a little messed up. I instantly related to this professor. I like this professor because he has two things, the professor with wild hair that the students see and the secret unseen professor that musses up his hair before entering the lecture hall so that he has a kind of professorial glamour. The reality of the professor is between those two things or as a result of their combination. He genuinely can't escape artifice. I saw Greg Bordowitz give a talk once where he spoke about the third thing that exists between two people. A sort of third person appears, and that's really the thing, this thirdness, the human prosody, a new space, a new person. Not person A, not person B, but some new thing, person C, a person that soars, a person like prayer. When I moved last year from Bushwick to the Upper West Side, a strange thing would happen to me while I was walking around the unfamiliar streets. My sense of space was different, also my sense of scale, and to some degree, also my sense of self. I felt different, and this feeling had a kind of shape I could almost see. I think looking back that I was having a new emotion. It's happened before, a sort of novel alchemical blend, but I never thought of it in these terms. It occurs to me that if I had named it, invented a new word to name the emotion, then it would have become real, a new emotion, one that I created or that was created within me by a confluence of countless subtle variables. I try to repeat this state, reactivate this emotion, but I can't. Maybe if I had applied a new word, could it then be duplicated, reduplicated? It gives me a lot of hope, a soaring feeling to consider that we have more options than just the emotions that are sold to us. The palette is far richer, the vocabulary far wider. walking around with that new feeling, I was both myself and also a version of myself, like poetry or parody or irony, spaces of overlap and double understanding. This is also the space of horror. Franny cries and cries, but the story ends with a moment of joyful hilarity, love and terror. In Coco, Dengler is kicked into a kind of ecstasy because extreme amounts of love and terror give rise within him to new emotions. He becomes the third thing that love and terror make. Excuse me. I remember when Colonel Kurtz says, "You must make a friend of horror. Horror and moral terror are your friends." Once when I was very sick in bed with a high fever in Benares, India, in a moment of intense anxiety verging on panic attack, poured a bottle of water over my head and slicked back my hair. And when my right hand settled on the back of my neck, a new thing happened. Between the feeling of my hand on my neck and the feeling of my neck on my hand, the space opened up, the space I could see, a dim room that overlapped the room where I was sitting in bed. I felt then that if I had left my hand there, I would also be able to enter that room. But I intimated that that might mean I would die. Touch is a room, like space in painting, prosody, and writing. I was frightened, even terrified, but attracted. It seemed that I contained more rooms than I had thought. At DIA Inn Beacon, there's a room with a piece by Lawrence Weiner that says, two slabs placed against each other to form a form with another slab lying on the ground. I tried to photograph the phrase, form a form, with my phone, but couldn't frame it without also getting some of the other words in the shot. Two slabs, place, the D in place, cut off above to form a form. Though I wanted to isolate the single phrase, the intrusion of the slabs clarified what I liked about the form of form. On one hand, each form is verb or noun, slabs a meaning, and is a slab of meaning or possibility of interpretation, malleable directive or observation. On the other hand, the two slabs meet and form a form, a third thing. William Burroughs and Brian Geisen were, like Greg Bordowitz, interested in the third term. They called it the third mind. When Burroughs and Geisen collaborated, they generated a new mind, a synergistic entity, more than the sum of its parts. In Fred Sandbach's installation at DIA, space is changed by so little. Single threads forming simple geometries suggest super thin glass panes suspended in air or leaning against the architecture, tilting either the space or my relation to it. A welcome vertigo, at once unsettling and playful, an astonishing amount of power and simple dyed thread. I thought of Rilke, the glorious theme that power plays with things, is to move in such submission through the world. Quiet upheaval. What is religious feeling? Did I experience that then? I felt something like a crystallizing awareness that serious play is sacred, holy, and DIA became a kind of church, a space for celebrating aesthetic space, time, and energy. Aesthetic equals engagement. Part of the power of these pieces that they reveal space as both idea and physical reality. Fold, repetition, refrain. The first horror movie I saw rented for me by my father from Videomania on Main Street in Boonton, New Jersey when I was about 10 years old was John Carpenter's The Thing. That's my work email. was John Carpenter's The Thing. It was one of his favorite movies, a movie he loved, and certainly his favorite horror movie. Part of what frightens us in horror is inescapability, the refrain of the antagonist, permutations of encounter, the always coming back. Horror loves its sequels. Part of what attracts us is the tension made by the meeting of attraction and repulsion, dread and anticipation. This is the unique prosodic space of horror, the space always on the threshold of itself. The Thing is a film about men. Male identity, male personhood. It's like a Western that way, an Antarctic Western. The hero, R.J. McCready, is essentially a cowboy, isolated himself, even within a group that is already completely isolated. The film makes me wonder, can a group of men sustain itself as a community? At the beginning of the film, it's clear that there is a kind of harmony, but it's a harmony based on impenetrable masculine boundaries and well-defined and well-understood male personas. It is undergirded tenuously, it turns out, by these men's shared sense of personhood, which manifests as a rigidly controlled set of behaviors and utterances. It doesn't take very long once the men start sharing something else, something other, something akin in its mutations and operations to poetic language, for this idea of personhood to start to disintegrate. The Thing is also about over-identification, over-inclusiveness, and excessive utterance. What third space erupts when this circle of men overlaps with the circle of an alien pilgrim, a circle that encompasses geologic time, infinite recombination, and an endless drive to write the next text? To be continued, what happens in the space between part one and sequel, that caesura and event horizon into which narrative disappears? The glorious game to move in such submission. That's from the Stephen Mitchell translation. Robert Bly has it. Strength plays such a marvelous game. It moves through the things of the world like a servant, groping out in roots, tapering in trunks. Auden, writing about Rilke in the New Republic in 1939, said, Rilke thinks of the human in terms of the non-human, what he calls things, dinge. In terms of, terminated or interminable. In my early days of sobriety, 2001, not long after 9/11, my sponsor handed me a pamphlet published by Hazel entitled Intimacy. You have a fear of intimacy, he said. Who are you kidding, I thought. Intimacy, that was my purview. What could any person or institution have to tell me about intimacy? I was a poet. As a drunken poet, I was intimacy itself. It moved through me like a servant. I was everything and everything's simultaneity. Paul Virilio, devout Catholic and theorist of thresholds, quotes Rilke in The Aesthetics of Disappearance. What happens is so far ahead of what we think of our intentions that we can never catch up with it and never really know its true appearance. For Virilio, as we progress, but we don't progress, we accelerate. As we accelerate, things, and here we must think of things as events, since only events are real, are suffused with an increasing flickering. In The Wild Boys, William Burroughs' uncontainable anarchist guerrilla boy heroes flicker desperately out of sync, deliberately out of sync with reality's filmic frame rate in order to time travel. As with Philip K. Dick, who knew that the Roman Empire never ended, if the light hits you slant, or actually if you hit the light slant, the asynchronous reel opens. Synchronicity is a crack in the surface. Don't you think that God does everything simultaneously? There's a certain slant of self. In the space between part one and sequel doesn't exist until the sequel exists. Then its interval blooms into being, the third thing that the two films create between them. This gap then retroactively creates the first film. I think that this is why people get so upset about sequels they don't like. It makes the original film work in terms of its existence. John Carpenter's The Thing opens with such beautiful footage, such a haunting, lightly percussive soundtrack. The first character we focus on is the aforementioned R.J. McCready, in solitude, shaggy, bearded, drinking scotch on the rocks and playing a game of computer chess. He's got this glassy-eyed and bemused confidence, a picture of masculine whimsy. But when the program quickly and dispassionately announces checkmate, McCready's face darkens. He pours his whiskey into the computer, it sparks and smokes. Cheating bitch, he grumbles. This moment is the only appearance of a woman in the entire film. The tinny, atonal, disembodied voice that attends the artificial intelligence that beats McCready at chess and pays the price by getting doused in JMB. Computers in this film, thus feminized, will continue to be the bearers of bad news for this isolated community of men. For men is to be defeated, to be betrayed. The Thing is a film about betrayal. More to the point, it's a film about men feeling betrayed, that their fantasy of boundaries has been violated, that it has been made into a ruined body. It's terrible enough that their physical boundaries, walls, weapons, skin, can't protect them from a bodily intrusion of cosmic otherness. What's worse, and never really expressed, is the horror at a chaos that doesn't conform to spatial, temporal, or conceptual rules, at an inscrutable, unpredictable, interminable event made flesh. When I first started trying to think seriously about poetry, and I can tell you I did not exactly feel equal to the task, I began to experience a profound anxiety about its purpose. More precisely, I felt that in order to justify writing poetry, I needed to figure out why one would resort to it in favor of prose, or, you know, just saying something, common casual utterance. In Coco, the murderer, a caesura dressed as a man who perceives himself as the center of a temporal and spatial simultaneity, speaks only very rarely and quite precisely. Coco's utterances are not common or casual. Aphoristic and full of inscrutable intention, they inspire immediate dread. Dread not because of impending violence, but because of vertigo, of void. Though precise, an aphorism is excessive. It contains more of itself than it has room for and is always moving upon its own threshold. Coco, I want to overlap this strange sing-songy nonsense word with the clocks of untitled Perfect Lovers and with Lesser Alvarez's Venn diagram drawing. A space made by a slippage of combined times, soaring into her in prayer without ceasing. When I relax my eyes while reading Coco, it reduplicates as a syllabic trinity, an infinite present. Does repetition exist or doesn't it? When MacReady and Dr. Copper, they go by Mac and Doc, sharp, definitive, authoritative, masculine appellations. When Mac and Doc first discover evidence of the thing, it's as its impression in an enormous block of ice. Though as the film progresses, or maybe I should say accelerates, we encounter increasingly grotesque iterations of this entity. The most intimate encounter with it is when Mac and Doc discover this empty form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form, but you have to say it. My early poetic impulses were aphoristic, maybe they still are, somewhat language poetry, somewhat Paul Celan. A tension, almost a conflict between expansion and compression. Celan's word inventions are language overlapping, blurred into a third clarity. Years after the fact, I realized that my sponsor was right. Intimacy is terrifying. It isn't easy to become a third thing. When we finally see the thing, it's always as an eruption, a riot, almost a panic. But a panic of what? Years after the fact, I feel somewhat comfortable with an undertaking that with an understanding that at least one reason to write poetry is to let language lead. It veers and it erupts. Whatever language is moves with such submission through me. Whatever I am moves through language like a servant. The men in the thing are on the threshold of their identities, brought there by an embodiment of a profound intimacy. What would happen if I became myself? Would I know I was me? The most interesting and least comfortable questions asked by Carpenter's film are, what is the thing in itself? What is its time? When one is taken over by the thing, does one know? Could you be the thing and not know it? Only know it once the material that you are reveals its inherent riot? When the thing takes you over, does it know it's the thing? Does it think it's you? Does the thing think? How to understand a force or entity that has none of its own boundaries, but only those of everything else? When Peter Straub was asked what it was like collaboratively writing The Talisman with Stephen King, he said he felt the book was not written by either of them, but by a third voice. Coco is a story about men and the shared brutality and trauma of their past speaking itself into their collective present. The only woman in that story, Maggie Law, knows that in order to live, one must move backwards and forwards through time at the same time. The Thing is a story about men who have no past and a featureless future, and so only an infinite and continuously renegotiated present. Years after the fact, I understand that poetry is what happens when language willfully misses the point in order to renegotiate the present. Be and be again. And a question for later, what happens to the shape of the space between stories when the sequel is a prequel? In other words, what happens when what happens after is what happened before? To be continued. Thanks very much.